Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
You need to be nimble and robust. So you need to be able to take a punch, and you also need to be quick and innovative and doing new things at a high speed. That's the best defense against the future. And you have to always be leaning into the future. If you're leaning away from the future is going to win every time.
Listeners, welcome back to the pod. It's Jazz here with John today. Our usual co-host friend is missing with us, David. He's a bit sick, so John and I are going to try and tackle the show today. John, how are you, my friend?
I'm very well, Jazz. How long are your hats, listeners? great. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good, mate. Really good. Been an interesting week again in the real estate space and the markets. Mm. Now that the election is out of the way, and 2020 is almost done. Another 2 or 3 weeks of property transactions. 3 weeks of property transactions. What are we making of 2020, and mate, some of the predictions for 2021? Are we about to dig into this stuff?
Why not? I mean, your Bitcoin prediction might have been the best one of that I've ever heard, but we can come to that.
Yeah, let's dig that towards the end. One of the news for this week was the chart that I shared with you, John, which is the overall number of total listings have dropped significantly in 2020. Even though we are out of the lockdown now, but the listings overall are way lower than last year and the years before that. Now, what do you make of that, John?
Yeah, we've talked about, there's a decline in listings, and we talk about the scarcity of stock. So there are a couple of things I'd say about it. Firstly, stock has been declining for a couple of years. We're actually, we say, we're about 20%. There's 20% fewer listings than last year. But what we don't say is there are actually 20% fewer listings the year before that. So if we compare ourselves like 2017-18, there are about 50% fewer listings. So it's not just that we're down on 2019, we're way down on a couple of years before that. So so a lot fewer listings. That's the first thing. The second thing I'd note is when you're in the real estate game, what's available is more important than how much is available. Mm-hmm. So people don't sell their best properties first. If you've got an investor with a big portfolio, they tend to unload the worst properties first and hoard their better properties. And so in tough times when people are forced to offload properties, they tend to offload the worst properties. And that's what we've seen the last couple of years, that the quality of the stock isn't fantastic. People are selling, perhaps, what we're seeing now is people aren't selling their houses, but they are selling their units. So in addition to fewer listings overall, about half of what there was about 3 years ago, we're seeing that the quality of the stock on the market's a lot lower. So, people in my game, it's making it challenging. But what do you make of it?
Yeah, I found it a little bit interesting. I honestly thought post the COVID lockdown in Victoria, New South Wales and other places that the listing numbers will shoot up a fair bit. But I never thought of comparing it to 2019 or the years before. But when you compare it, those numbers are still pretty low. You and I were discussing before the recording that is it baby boomers trying to hold on to their properties for whether it's the capital gains or the market is, baby boomers are pretty savvy investors to some extent. Their experience that they are trying to hold on to the properties to get the best out of them in the next year or two when the market kicks into full gear. Whereas this year has been a little bit of a lost year to some extent. So that's possibly one thought, that it's the baby boomers holding on to it. The other is that people are just a little bit, I don't know about this one, to be honest, but maybe people are just a little bit nervous about transacting in this environment, and they're keeping their listings low because of the instability with the COVID and their job situation overall, and borders closed if they want to move around, which slowly now they are opening up, but that that mindset shift will, it will take a little bit of time for them to get over 2020 and start making their life go back to normal next year.
So. Yeah. What it tells me something else. I like those points actually, particularly about the baby boomers, because they're like a basketball moving through a hose. I mean, economically, they're the biggest and most powerful demographic in society, even still. And if there aren't properties being sold, it's in a sense because they're not selling. And we've said on this podcast before about stimulus and lowering interest rates. And we say that, you know, there's no amount of stimulus that is going to make a 75-year-old baby boomer want to buy another property. It's just they're just not at that stage of life. And so one of the reasons stimulus isn't creating the inflation that the central banks want is because the demographic that can make that stimulus happen aren't investing in real estate. Mm. But seemingly nor are they selling. So that's quite interesting as well. I guess one other thing is that by reducing interest rates so aggressively, it's taken the distressed sellers out of the game. So, you know, in any market, you've got the people who are upsizing and downsizing, but you've also got that component of people who are just in distress. They have to offload some properties. Mm-hmm. Now, are there many real estate owners that are in distress at 1.9% fixed mortgage rate over 3 years? I'm not sure. I don't know if there's, I mean, right now I don't see the distress. That might be the tsunami that's coming though, but.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just strong hands holding tight, watching the markets. And if the prices start to move up next year, that will give them more confidence to bring the properties on the market and move to more lifestyle locations or downsize wherever they feel like to some extent.
Yes, yeah, so supply is always like the market's shock absorber. And that's like any market in real estate in particular, you know, when everyone expected prices would collapse, the supply dried up. And the supply dried up faster than the buyers retreated. And so you had fairly robust prices. But that'll moderate once the supply comes back. And it's this, for you know, permanent tug of war between buyers and sellers that brings stability to the market and stability to the prices. So it's interesting.
That's a good start. We strayed into the property game already without looking at the big macro picture that we normally look at, but let's just keep going. That's our style. auction clearance numbers as well. What do you make of that this week or the last week, basically?
The auction clearance rates were really kind of steady. I mean, in a sense, there's no new news compared to what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. I'd say that we're still in a seller's market. But just to go round the traps, Sydney had an auction clearance rate of 76.4%, which was down from 79% the week before. And it was 80% last year. So it's still around that 75 to 80%. You would still consider that a kind of a seller's market, which is favourable for prices. Melbourne bounced right back there. Melbourne's been a hard market to measure, you know, I mean, and it almost been pointless to measure clearance rates in Melbourne, but the clearance rates in Melbourne were about 77% off increasing volumes, and that compared to 74% the previous week and 71% the previous year. So actually, Melbourne's clearance rates were higher than last year, although the volumes were about half. And one thing we didn't mention when we're talking about the number of properties for sale is that Melbourne is distorting the numbers a lot. So a lot of the volumes have come back to Sydney and Canberra and so on, but Melbourne is a such a big market and it's distorting and lowering those volume numbers. On to Brisbane at 72% compared to 60% the previous week and 60% the previous year. So Brisbane's way up. Watch Brisbane. I think we've been waiting for Brisbane for about 5 years and I think it might be happening now. Adelaide, really strong. Adelaide's really volatile. So last week it was 88% clearance rate and this week it's just under 70%. So not a strong auction market, but bouncing around. Mm-hmm. And Canberra at 71% compared to 90% the week before.
Mm-hmm.
and 68% the previous year. I don't have Perth here, but it's a real mix. I'd say that broadly speaking, everything is positive. Some of those very high numbers from the week before they came out,
mm-hmm.
So they've kind of normalized a little bit, but really positive.
Yeah. Melbourne's the interesting one. Yeah, the total number of listings are way down, 50%, and that's probably something to be watched next year. But I was speaking to the agent, some of the local agents in Melbourne. Properties are selling super fast. The ones that are coming on the market, they're not holding onto the market for long if they are priced and marketed properly. But the trend is definitely in the right direction. It's just the listings. Brisbane, Adelaide, and Canberra, there's never much point talking of them. It's just mainly Sydney and Melbourne. Sydney, without a doubt, has been a constant performer, and you're the best man for Sydney. But Melbourne seems to be joining the party as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's you talked about the time on market, which is a really important measure to see how hot a market is. And what we're seeing is the time on market's quite low for houses. Houses are flying and units aren't. And I go out there every weekend and I'm in the market in Sydney. I'm doing a lot of buying in the inner west at the moment, in the inner western lower north shore. And I would say that it's very mixed. You know, and what I try to do, because I can do private inspections during the week, but I like to go on Saturdays just to see which properties are hot and which properties aren't. And it's really hard to put your finger on what's determining what a hot property is. So some I'm waiting in lines out the front as they usher us in slowly through the property, and others are just, I'm the only one there. I'd say that houses are flying, units, it's really mixed. It's just about, there's a bit of a flight to quality, so you can tell what the good properties are. Mm. And you can't even say that it's old versus new, because some old properties are hot and some old properties are not. And some new properties are hot and so on. So it's really about the quality. And people, one thing I think that is making a difference is people are really looking for those north-facing, bright, natural bright units. And I suppose they were always in high demand, but that flight to quality makes those little things a lot more desirable at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Layouts are always a big deal.
Yep.
So we're seeing, but houses are strong and units are very patchy.
Mm-hmm. And that's something we've discussed in the past as well, that the houses probably in the middle ring, outer suburbs, will be a bit more stronger because of the whole shift towards housing to some extent. But the interesting thing, and that naturally leads me into my next point, was the article that you sent me, John, where New South Wales office workers are supposed to return back to their desk or the office from next year. And this is something that we have discussed, whether the work will go more remote or partly remote kind of thing, and how that will impact the property market. Now, this news came out earlier in the week. What do you make of this piece of news? And if we can tie it back to the property, basically.
Yeah. So just I'll read a sentence from an AFR article that we're talking about. It says, Premier Gladys Berejiklian announced on Wednesday that her government would lift a public health order on December the 14th, requiring employers to allow employees to work from home unless it was absolutely necessary they were in the office.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, it's been very sort of symmetric and in favour of employees wanting to work from home. And there was a bit of a government backing to that perspective. What we're seeing now is that employers are going to be able to start to force, I suppose the right word is, or encourage their workers to come back to the office. And we'll see that more and more in 2021. In terms of what it means, on this podcast, we talked about an expectation that there would be some political pressure to get people to come back to the office. And if you think about who a collapse in commercial property would impact, it would be those big companies like Dexus, Lendlease, and so on, that own a lot of the commercial properties and build a lot of the commercial properties, but also the banks. The banks have a lot of debt against these commercial retail and office spaces. So I think that there would be some political pressure. It's hard to know how much, but there'd be some political pressure to get these offices filled up again. because that's where the value of commercial property is. It's always in the occupancy and the lease, and that's different to residential property, which is not about whether you have a 5-year lease or not. So yeah, I think some political pressure asserted itself. It's probably healthy that, you know, that people get back into the swing of things. But yeah, well, I'd expect to see people go back to work. In terms of what it means for residential, I kind of feel like there'll be a bit of a reversal of the trend we saw in 2020 to favour outer ring suburbs with houses. I think that there'll be a bit of a correction back to inner or middle ring apartments or suburbs. I think that, you know, we're going back to places like the Inner West, Lower North Shore, some parts of the South. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I agree with most part of what you have said, that it's a, I think there will be a bit of a, well, one is the political pressure that you and I again were discussing before the recording, that there's that this is partly political pressure that will cause it, since a lot of the, when you look at some of the big funds that are invested in the commercial real estate, if the commercial real estate doesn't goes back to or close to where it was, then that creates a lot of challenge for those funds, like super funds, as an example, is the big example. But on top of that, I think there's going to be a bit of a fist fight between the tech giants and more online savvy companies who can actually save money by reducing their corporate space and letting people work from home. And they'll prefer that to some extent. It may not be 5 days a week from home, but maybe 1 or 2 days, which we have discussed as well in the past. And if that happens, then again, it's a trend shift. And if that trend shift stays here and becomes permanent, then it all goes back to what we have discussed in the past of what kind of properties will perform. So whether it's the regional areas or more the outer suburbs and all that stuff. So it's the...
Yeah. I mean, I guess one way to look at this news item is that just because an employer can ask people to go back to the office doesn't mean that that will happen. I went for drinks last Friday with a mate. He had a baby and we were wetting the baby's head. The baby was nowhere to be seen, by the way. I think it was just about the beer. but I was chatting to a guy and he was saying, and he worked in the city, and he was saying that his boss came up to him and said, you know, Joe Blow, you ready to come back to work? And he said, are you kidding? He said, an hour to get there, an hour to get back, half an hour to get ready. He said, you're getting a lot more out of me working from home than you'd ever get from me, you know, sort of trudging about getting into and from the city.
Yeah.
Money you spent is save on lunch. So his boss was totally cool with that, according to the story at least. Yeah. So, you know, there has been a shift.
Look, it's all at the end of the day, getting the best productivity out of the employees. Yeah. That's the key here, right? And if technologies like Zoom can allow that to happen, then I think employers will just start adapting to it. Yeah. That's just some of the big forces that we discussed, like the hedge funds and others, that will force the regulators to push towards the back to office culture. Otherwise, the damage in the commercial space can be pretty big. So, and we have discussed that too.
Yep.
Now, generally, we go with the macro, start with the macro and then go into the property. But this time we have changed it a little bit because David's not here. And I my world is always upside down.
you're a maverick, Jazz.
So the next one is, again, this one was shared by you, John, is the bond defaults, bailouts over the Chinese state-owned enterprises. So there are basically in China bond defaults currently happening. I honestly haven't read it properly to be able to say a lot, but let's see what your thoughts are first.
Yeah, I was listening to some financial channel at the beginning of the week, and there was a mini corporate bond crash last week in China. And so it was a crash in corporate bonds triggered by some defaults. And the defaults were some reasonably big names. The company that triggered it was a company called Brilliance Auto. And there were some coal mining companies that defaulted on their loans. And a couple of things makes this interesting. One is that in China, the Chinese government bail out companies all the time and they don't allow these companies to go broke. But for some reason, they're allowing these defaults. Now, they could be picking winners, maybe not. Maybe there's some problems at the government. I don't know. But what's interesting is there has been a bit of a sell-off in corporate bonds. And the default rate for these Chinese companies spiked to 6% when it was under 2% a couple of weeks earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure it's an impact of COVID. There's bankruptcies and there's cash flow issues and all that sort of stuff. But what makes this interesting is, why didn't the government bail these companies out? I have no idea, but it's interesting. It's just something to watch, and it's one of those little news items that gets that flies below the radar for most of us. Mm. In this article, they use words like credit crunch, credit crisis brewing in China. Maybe not, but it's interesting to see that they're not bailing them out.
There's surely something cooking. What that is, we'll have to dig a little bit more. Maybe we'll do a follow-up on this as we find out more about it. But currently, I don't have a lot to say on this one.
Me neither.
What else have we got for the day to cover, mate?
Well, while we're on macro, there was a lot of talk of vaccines. You know, I think Pfizer came out and said, actually our vaccine is 95% effective and the markets loved it. So we're in this weird holding pattern where we've got vaccines coming out. There's been about three companies coming out with news on vaccines that's all positive. We've had the election that's still being figured out, although I think the market settled on a Biden win.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the market wanting stimulus. So because we're kind of in the wake of the election, there isn't any stimulus being passed. So we're in a very interesting time. So what happened in the last week was oil surged on the news of the vaccine. Gold got absolutely slammed. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about that. And Bitcoin, very interesting. You know, I'm not a Bitcoin guy, but Bitcoin nearly got to $20,000. And I don't know where it was last week, but it was like 16,000, or at the beginning of November, it would have been like 13,000 or so.
Yeah, so it almost doubled in, I think, 3 months or something.
Wow.
Just to add on to what you said, yes, gold definitely got hammered on the news, but gold also went up a lot in the last couple of months in March. And I think this sell-off, you and I were expecting to some extent, it's more where the sell-off was going to end and whether this is the end of the sell-off, like you and I were discussing before, whether the 200 MA is the key test here, which it has done. Now, it will be interesting to see whether it's successful or not. But from everything we can tell, and we have discussed a lot about gold and silver on this podcast as well, the trend is still towards north. We still expect prices to be a lot higher in the next 2 to 3 years. I think it's just seeing a natural sell-off after going up like anything. And just to add to on the Bitcoin part, I think Bitcoin's done pretty much the same thing. It went from 10K to 20K within span of 2 or 3 months. And now it's seeing the correction as well. I think currently it's sitting at, I can't remember, but around 17K or something. So all of these, and plus before Christmas, there is that sell-off period anyways.
Yeah, I think the market's waiting for stimulus. And I think that Biden needs to coordinate his team for that to happen. And the market kind of expected a stimulus package before the election, which is a month ago now, really. And so the absence of a stimulus package is like, well, what's driving gold?
Mm.
And plus, you add the vaccines in, and there's a lot of optimism. I think there's too much optimism in the market, and I think that I think Q1 is going to be very interesting next year.
Mm-hmm.
When the reporting season comes around, perhaps the numbers aren't quite as good, but we'll see. There's a lot of reasons to be optimistic as well. Gold is interestingly is like a fair trade. Silver is a greed trade.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got things like oil and copper and nickel, which are economic growth drivers. So, you know, the market's pricing in a recovery. It's not, and so we just need to wait and see for stimulus. I think gold's going to, it's on a in a secular bull market, which means a long-term bull market.
Mm-hmm.
But we will have to see.
I still think that Fed's balance sheet will double next year. So currently it's at 7 trillion. It's a big call. I'm saying it will be at 14 trillion. And if that's true, then there's a lot more stimulus on its way, one way or the other.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely, it's just timing, you know, the market sort of is very, sometimes very present oriented. So because there's no stimulus right now, it assumes it'll never happen. I mean, there's definitely stimulus coming.
Yeah.
It's just when and what does it look like?
Yeah.
You know, I heard a podcast where they said that this is a little bit, oh, I mean, I don't really agree with this, but I think it's quite an interesting thing I'll throw out that, the reason for the delay in the stimulus might be because they're trying to perfect Fedcoin. So they're trying to digitize the currency, and so they're delaying it until that's ready, and then they can push out stimulus and be more in control of how it gets spent. I don't actually buy into that argument, but I thought it's an interesting perspective.
That's a very interesting thought. I never actually, it didn't even occur to me that they maybe... We all know that the Fed has been working on the Fed coin, and China has already trialed their digital currency. So it's all a rumor at the moment, but I think it's definitely in works for next year. And it makes sense what you just said. If there is a digital currency, it becomes a lot easier to control it, to track it.
Well, their great concern is that they push all this money out the door in this really kind of this tsunami fashion where money just goes out, which from a free market perspective is fairly irresponsible. But they want to, you know, the worst thing that can happen in their opinion is that we save the money. And from a free market perspective, saving money is excellent because that, you know, it's capital accumulation and all that sort of stuff. But from a stimulus perspective, they want to see it get spent. So Fedcoin can be a tool that they can use to make sure that the money filters back into the places they want it to go, which is basically consumption items.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. I agree on that, actually. It'll be interesting to see when it comes out next year, if it does.
2020 just continues to be extremely interesting. I mean, a turning point in many ways. You know, we certainly weren't talking about Fedcoin a year ago.
Mm.
So, yeah, very, very interesting times. You know, there's a real difference between what they call mainstream and Main Street and Wall Street, which means the real economy is kind of suffering at the moment. The financial economy is doing really well. And those two lines can only diverge for so long. It's a bit of an unhealthy concoction.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to watch for 2021.
Mm-hmm. I think that covers the most of it. So that's awesome. To the listeners, hope you guys enjoyed the content. And we'll see you guys next Friday with more news. Play safe and stay safe. Cheers. Cheers and John.